Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the capture of the counter-revolution against the Morsi government by the Egyptian army and the Mubarak-era police, which appears to have been financed and encouraged by the Saudi Arabian monarchy, determined to sabotage Egypt's democratic experiment for fear it will spread to their autocratic kingdom. We'll begin with the Islamic scholar Dr. Khalid Abu El Fadl, the author of The Great Theft, Wresting Islam from the Extremists, and discuss the growing death toll of young Egyptians and his article in Monday's New York Times, The Peril of the People's Coup. Then we'll speak with Mark Rottenberg, the President and Executive Director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, who today petitioned the Supreme Court to stop the NSA spying on American citizens, arguing that the FISA court had exceeded its authority under Section 215 of the Patriot Act. We will discuss EPIC's petition to the highest court that directly challenges the NSA's authority to sweep up domestic communications. Then finally, we'll examine the latest efforts to kill the Dodd-Frank financial reforms that resulted from the 2008 crash. Dennis Kelleher, the president of Better Markets, a nonprofit that promotes the public interest in the U.S. and global financial markets, joins us to discuss the House bill derisively known as the London Whale Loophole Act that would eviscerate regulation over the $700 trillion derivatives market. Joining us now is Dr. Khalid Abu El Fadl, who is a distinguished professor of law at the UCLA School of Law, where he teaches international human rights, Islamic jurisprudence, national security law, law, terrorism, Islam and human rights, political asylum and political crimes and legal systems. He is the author of The Great Theft, Wresting Islam from the Extremist, and he has an article in Monday's New York Times, Perils of a People's Coup. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Khalid El Fadl.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And I spoke yesterday with Jawad Nabulsi, who's one of the organizers of the original revolution, and he gave a very bleak portrait of what's happening. It appears that the counter-revolution against Morsi, which has been driven by protests where a petition of 22 million people asked Morsi to step down, and the original people who brought about the original revolution are largely a part of that group. But it appears that the Mubarak-era police, and perhaps in collusion with the army, trying to capture the counter-revolution and basically misreading it as a rejection of democracy instead of a rejection of Morsi. Is that your understanding of what's happening?
No, yes, that's actually quite accurate and quite perceptive as well. The progression of events leading up to this coup is a very important part of the story, because right after whether it's the presidential elections or the parliamentary elections and the parliament that was abrogated or the Shura Council elections, in this whole, and these are six different electoral votes, and with a net result of zero. And throughout this process, there was the reappearance of sort of the old corrupt centers of power who own television stations. They're privately owned, and newspapers. And these television stations and newspapers did nothing night and day except give Egyptian citizens the sense of insecurity and the sense of pending doom. At the same time, Saudi Arabia kept Egypt in a steady state of shortage of gas and oil, and so you had constant electricity short outs and constant suddenly queues would form at gas stations and so on, all which was miraculously lifted right after the coup, by the way. And it was clear that these forces were intent on, and many of the old Mubarak partners reemerged again now this time as critics of as democratically so-called committed. I doubt very much the commitment to any democratic system, but sort of playing the role of democratic critics of the government. And unfortunately, I feared and expected, and then frankly tried to warn against, is that the numbers of protesters who had a lot of reasons to protest was immediately jumped on by the military, and a very important player here is Amn al-Dawla, or the state security apparatus. I mean, the security apparatus was extremely not just offended, but they felt degraded after the revolution, because several of their centers were stormed, their files were opened, and during the revolution they were constantly attacked, and their policies of torturing and killing people exposed, and so on. And what they did is that they refused, as sort of the police on the ground, they refused to perform their job. So Morsi is the president, and yet the police is absent from the streets, absent from even regulating traffic. Crimes would occur, and the police is nowhere. The security apparatus reappeared now in full force. That's the same apparatus that I think is actually responsible for the massacre that took place yesterday, killing 54 and injuring. Typical methods of repression and torture and so on have suddenly reappeared as well. So it is a great worry. I believe that it was essential that while we send a very strong message to the Morsi government saying that you are incompetent and that we want you to step down, but at the same time that there would be an equally strong message that we do not want the military involved in another coup, and a complete rejection of the idea of a military takeover and promises of turning it into some... The military should not be allowed to pick which civilians they want in power. It's egregious precedent.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Khaled Abu El Fadl, who is a distinguished professor of law at the UCLA School of Law. He's the author of The Great Theft, Wrestling Islam from the Extremists, and he has an article in Monday's New York Times, The Perils of a People's Coup. And in your article, you say no country did more to undermine Mr. Morsi's government and celebrate its fall than Saudi Arabia. The Saudis understand that the threat that the Egyptian democratic experiment once posed to Saudi autocracy is gone. And, of course, that is illustrated by the fact that when the coup was announced by the army general, standing right next to him are the leaders of the Saudi-funded Salafist al-Nur party. They've already rejected Mohammed al-Baradei as the prime minister. So the Saudis, they bought a coup, right?
I mean, they had played a very... The role of the saboteur, I would say, throughout this process. One very telling tool or a piece of evidence that we can look at is the Arabiya Channel, which was created by Saudi Arabia as a counterbalance to Jazeera. Arabiya had, since the election of Morsi, had done nothing but a steady stream of, alarmist coverage, much of it just simply inaccurate and so on. Of course, and they celebrated the coup and continued to do so rather without... any reservations. I mean, there's not even an attempt to sort of play along with the appearance of objectivity. But other than that, what must be understood is that Many Saudi princes and influential people like Bandar bin Sultan and Amir Turki and many from the ruling family and their patrons had a great amount invested in the Mubarak regime because the Mubarak regime allowed them to purchase a great deal of real estate, prime real estate, for way below market value, basically through bribes. And so they have a deep financial interest in the perpetuation of a corrupt system in Egypt. And one of the things that they ran into after Mubarak was overthrown was the removal of the state prosecutor who, the one who was just reinstated by the Egyptian judiciary, who had a long history of looking the other way when it comes to the corruption, corrupt deals involving Saudi princes and Saudi investments. That was one of the key factors that made them determined to, initially they were quite vocal about supporting Mubarak and threatened, before Morsi's election, made threats to it caused all types of financial damage to the Egyptian economy if Mubarak was put on trial. But ultimately, they made peace with the military, and very much the military became the guarantor for them. The military very much said, you know, don't worry about the democratic process. We will make sure that the state policies do not become unbearable to you. That promise started being difficult to keep under the Morsi government because of the six elections the Morsi government, while an incompetent government, but it was not a corrupt government. They were not out to make money and get rich, and they were not playing along with the sort of Saudi interest paradigm. And so, since that time, Egypt was hit with one shortage after another, very much sort of like economic sabotage. And ultimately, of course, they were the first to congratulate Sisi. And by the way, the current transition president appointed by the army is a man who worked in Saudi Arabia for over 10 years, member of the Egyptian Supreme Court, who is now the acting president. So he has extensive ties with Saudi Arabia and sort of a history of accommodating Saudi interests. And so it is a bleak picture. And the revolution is being, I think the revolution has been stolen. The question is, will enough Egyptians wake up to realize that you cannot build a democracy by undermining the electoral process? That politics has to remain a civilian dynamic, a civilian struggle, and has to remain civic, where the army and especially Amn al-Dawla or the security forces are not prepared to lose what they believe are the gains and advantages made through this coup without a fight. And that's why, for instance, the massacre that took place is a result of that. They will kill and have arrested. There's about 100 people who have just been picked up from their homes yesterday, that in addition to another 200 that have been picked up in the past week. And I'm sure that they're being tortured and, you know, so on. So the army and the security forces will put up a fight, and there will be a very bloody cost to try to undo the effects of this military coup. There are a lot of Egyptians who want to believe that this is a people's coup, that that these are just the demonstrators in Tahrir were represented the Egyptian sovereign, and that the army simply acted to give effect to the will of the people, and that now the army is simply being a good faith ambassador, and the army will put into place a process that will put the democratic train right on track, and which will continue just marching along as if nothing has happened. Of course, I mean, that view is so naive and so burdened by blinders that it's literally disastrous.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here, Dr. Khaled Abu El Fadl. It's no surprise that during the original revolution, Obama got phone calls every day from the Saudi king screaming at him, saying, mm-hmm. "Let Mubarak kill those kids in Tahrir." Now they've got their second chance, and they bought a coup, and people don't get it. And I'm very grateful for you to pointing out the reality of this situation.
You're welcome. I wish we will speak again under better circumstances.
Definitely. Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Khaled Abu El Fadl, who's a distinguished professor of law at the UCLA School of Law, where he teaches international human rights, Islamic jurisprudence, national security law, law, terrorism, Islam and human rights, political asylum and political crimes and legal systems. He's the author of The Great Theft, Wrestling Islam from the Extremists, and has an article in Monday's New York Times, The Perils of a People's Coup. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking with the head of an organization that's petitioning the Supreme Court to overturn the FISA court's ability to allow the NSA to spy on American citizens.
أنا بحبك يا بلادي
يا بلادي يا بلادي أنا بحبك يا بلادي يا بلادي.
On the next edition of Uprising, we'll get an update in the case of the state versus George Zimmerman over last year's killing of Trayvon Martin. And imprisoned attorney Lynn Stewart fights for her life. We'll speak with her husband. Plus an in-depth look at the immigration reform bill. Join me, Sonali Kolhatkar, on Uprising weekdays at 8 a.m. right here at KPFK.
واسمي شهيدك دمي بيجري في دم وريدك صوت الحر يا مصر نشيدك انا انفاسك انا تنهيدك انا نبضك نبض الجماهير صوتك في ميدان التحرير امل الثوره والتغيير هرمك نيلك حلمي.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mark Rottenberg, who is the President and Executive Director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, in Washington, D.C. He teaches information privacy law at Georgetown University Law Center and frequently testifies before the Congress on emerging privacy and civil liberties issues. He has served on several national and international advisory panels, including the expert panel on cryptography policy and computer security for the OECD, the legal experts on cyber law for UNESCO, and he chairs the American Bar Association's Committee on Privacy and Information Protection. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Rottenberg.
Nice to be with you.
And Mark, your organization, the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, today petitioned the Supreme Court, citing exceptional circumstances that only the High Court can address. What are these exceptional circumstances?
Well, it concerns, of course, the NSA's routine collection of telephone toll records in the United States. And the order that authorized this collection by the National Security Agency, we believe, was without a legal basis. So we have filed an appeal with the U.S. Supreme Court asking the Supreme Court, essentially, to overturn the order of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. It's the only court that we believe can review these decisions and therefore the appropriate court for our appeal.
So you can't go to the FISA court itself. Is that what you're saying?
Right. The FISA court's a very unusual court. It was, and interestingly, actually it was established to originally safeguard civil liberties and privacy. It was one of the outcomes of the Church Committee's work of the 1970s, which had found abuse by the U.S. law enforcement and intelligence agencies. And what the FISA court originally sought to do was to deal with the unusual circumstances surrounding a national security surveillance order. And it put in place certain safeguards, but it was also a secret court. Not much is published about the court. The understanding throughout the history of this court was that the efforts would be directed toward the gathering of foreign intelligence. And the reason we brought our petition to the Supreme Court is because if you read this document that has been recently made public regarding Verizon's requirement to provide all of this information about its customers, it's just extraordinary to us.
That's the document that Snowden leaked, right?
Yes, that's correct. But it's extraordinary. If you read this document, it compels Verizon, one of the leading telephone companies, of course, in the U.S., to provide on an ongoing basis all of the call detail records on its customers. It's absolutely without precedent, clearly contrary to the purpose of the law, and we think needs simply to be overturned. The Supreme Court needs to recognize that there's simply not a legal basis to give the National Security Agency information, so much information about U.S. consumers engaging in domestic communications.
And again, I'm speaking with Mark Rottenberg, the President and Executive Director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, who today petitioned the Supreme Court to stop the FISA court, who have exceeded its statutory jurisdiction in ordering the production of millions of domestic telephone records that arguably cannot be relevant to an authorized investigation, given that Section 215 of the Patriot Act provision that's been cited by the FISA court required that the business records produced be relevant to an authorized national security investigation. And I guess you're arguing, Mark Rottenberg, that it's completely implausible that all the details of every American that's telephoned, in other words, every American is being turned into a terrorist suspect. How could that be relevant?
Well, this is a very critical point that you've made, and it is the key part of our argument, that in that controversial provision of the Patriot Act, Section 215, the government was nonetheless required to establish relevance to compel the production of this personal information. It has to be relevance, by the way, to an authorized investigation, which is a second hurdle. And when you look at the scope of the order, which says to the telecommunications firm, it must provide all call detail records on all customers on an ongoing basis, it's simply inconceivable that such a broad order could satisfy that legal standard. And that's the issue that we would like the Supreme Court to consider, because if the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court exceeded its authority, the order on its face is unlawful. Verizon should not have complied with it, and that information should not have been turned over to the National Security Agency.
Well, I spoke with an NSA whistleblower a while back, William Binney, and he was saying that this vast complex that's being developed in Utah is designed to store all this metadata information that they are scooping up and have been scooping up. Of course, these revelations from Edward Snowden, reveal something that's ongoing, and it certainly hasn't been stopped. Are you surprised, Mark, that there in Washington, there's not a bigger cry against what's happening here in terms of our civil liberties?
I think, in fairness, there has been a substantial objection. And as we learn more about this program, I think people are becoming more concerned. I think You know, people who use the internet, people who rely on their cell phones, are starting to ask the question, why is their personal information being provided to the National Security Agency for review? I mean, I don't think there's any dispute as to the need to protect the nation's security or to identify terrorist threats. That's never a point of contention. The debate is actually about a very different problem, which is why is it that the NSA gets access to so much information about so many people who are clearly unrelated to any criminal or terrorist conduct? And I think we have actually found a way to put the issue, you know, fairly and directly before the Supreme Court. Maybe they will conclude that the authority is legal. Maybe they will say that the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court had the right to do what they did, in which case, you know, we go to Congress and we say there's a problem here. Or what I think is more likely is that the Supreme Court will look at this and say, well, this is clearly not what Congress anticipated.
Well, I was actually suggesting, Mark, that the American public is certainly upset about it, and they're ahead of the politicians. But I haven't seen a great deal of political pushback from the U.S. Senate, from the Democrats. The president himself talked about the need for a national debate. And certainly Edward Snowden himself said that he was leaking this information in order to start an awareness on the part of the American people. His trajectory has been somewhat sidetracked by being a fugitive and whether or not the information he's carrying with him has been compromised. And so in terms of the traditional long-standing debate between civil liberties versus national security, it feels as if the pendulum is switching more in the favor of the national security community, less in the favor of the civil liberties union community. Do you detect this national debate?
Well,
Obama's talked about.
Very, you know, I understand, of course, what you're saying, but I have a very different perception. And I've been in Washington for a very long time, working on these issues and helping to draft privacy laws, advising members of Congress, working with technology experts. I would say that this is the most significant development since 9/11, and I think the pendulum is swinging in the other direction. I think it's swinging toward the protection of privacy. I think it reflects greater skepticism about the claims that have been made by government on behalf of these surveillance programs. And one of the remarkable facts is that when we actually have the opportunity to examine these documents, and there are many lawyers who are examining these documents, I mean, we are all just very surprised. You know, you can talk about, you know, Big Brother surveillance and the NSA's plans for Utah, but still, when you read this order that was signed by Judge Vinson, which says to a U.S. company, turn over all of your records on all of your customers on an ongoing basis for solely domestic communications, you pause and you ask the question, did the court actually have the authority to do that? And we believe the answer is no.
Well, then, I don't mean to beat a dead horse here, Mark, but who in Washington, in terms of our political leadership, is speaking up on behalf of the American people who are rightly outraged by what is happening?
Well, I think there have been certainly in the Senate, you know, many members, Senators Wyden and Udall, have for a long time been intimating that this Section 215 authority has been misused. Senator Rand Paul has objected to this expansive surveillance activity. I was struck, actually, by Congressman James Sensenbrenner, who was one of the original co-sponsors of the Patriot Act and one of the greatest defenders of the need for the country to take aggressive measures after 9/11. When he read how Section 215 authority had been used, he said this was never what we intended. This is not the law that we passed. And when the person who created legal authority speaks publicly against how that provision is being used, I think people listen to that. I think they understand that somehow, you know, the court has, and I mean now the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, has gone off the rails. And I don't mean, you know, in speaking about these issues to disparage the members of the court. They're federal judges. They have a very important role in our judiciary system. But this authority and the secrecy have combined in a way to produce outcomes that we don't believe are supported by the law.
So presumably, just in the last couple of minutes here, Mark Rottenberg, presumably you're petitioning the Supreme Court is going to get a lot of people's attention and perhaps put some wind at the back of the politicians to do something, because the American people, I think, are demanding it.
Well, there are lots of different ways, I think, to address this issue. You know, Congress is holding oversight hearings. 26 senators recently wrote to Director Clapper, asked him a series of questions to try to determine how he saw the scope of his authority.
Right, well, he's already lied to the Congress.
Well, yes, but I mean, I think it's still significant that almost a quarter, more than a quarter of the U.S. Senate, you know, took the time to write to Mr. Clapper and say, we're interested in your views.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that does actually reflect concern in Washington. There's been an incredible amount of very good reporting. And actually our petition, which I think is significant, focuses on a narrow issue. It's a critical issue. It's a narrow issue. It basically asks the question, does the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court have the authority to issue these orders that it has issued? And if the answer is no, and we think the answer is no, that means those orders have to be vacated. They have to be overturned, and the companies have to stop producing this information.
Well, Mark Rottenberg, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Nice speaking with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Mark Rottenberg, who's the president and executive director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, in Washington, D.C. He teaches information privacy law at Georgetown University Law Center and frequently testifies before the Congress on emerging privacy and civil liberties issues. He also is an expert witness on panels of the cryptology policy and computer security for the OECD and legal experts on cyberspace law for UNESCO, and he chairs the American Bar Association's Committee on Privacy and Information Protection. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the latest efforts on the part of the House of Representatives to kill the Dodd-Frank Act.
Join us on Sojourner Truth every Tuesday to Friday, 7 to 8 a.m. Tune in for weekly roundtables, special series, in-depth interviews, open phones, guest hosts, youth-produced stories, our special commentary teams, and more. Our coverage is local, national, and international. Check us out and tell everyone you know to tune in. Sojourner Truth every Tuesday to Friday, 7 a.m. for fearless drive-time radio on KPFK. Follow Sojourner Truth on Twitter at SoTrueKPFK. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dennis Kelleher, who is the President and Chief Executive Officer of Better Markets Incorporated, a Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit organization that promotes the public interest in the U.S. and global financial markets. Better Markets is a Wall Street watchdog and has been referred to as a persistent thorn in the side of Wall Street. Dennis has held several senior staff positions in the United States Senate, most recently as the chief counsel and senior leadership advisor to the chairman of the Senate Democratic Policy Committee. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dennis Kelleher.
Hi, Ian. How are you?
Good, thanks, Dennis. And basically, the House Appropriations Committee approved this agriculture budgeting bill, which will significantly restructure banking regulations as a part of what appears to be the GOP's effort to protect Wall Street's offshore trading in derivatives. And I understand that they've rolled in $19 billion of other spending. So describe the bill and its chances of passage, and then we can get into the whole notion of what these derivatives markets are really about.
Sure. It's a classic congressional ploy where you pass a bill that has got a bunch of goodies for as many members as you can think of so that you can buy as many votes as possible. That's what the $19 billion is meant to do. And then, of course, you put within it, you smuggle in there something that's actually nefarious and that many people would not support. But when they're faced with supporting the overall bill or not, they too often vote for the goodies and try and ignore the nefarious parts. So that's, unfortunately, a time-honored and well-worn congressional stratagem to get dirty deeds done in legislation. And in this case, the dirty deed is fundamentally to gut the CFTC's attempt to impose strong regulation on cross-border derivatives deals. And although that sounds complex, what it really boils down to virtually every person in America, is that derivatives are what caused the financial world to blow up last time. And Wall Street's derivatives and their reckless trading of derivatives is what actually caused the collapse and what caused the U.S. taxpayers and government to have to bail out Wall Street. And that's what's at stake over whether or not derivatives are going to be regulated and how strongly. And the provisions in this bill would prevent that regulation from happening and therefore actually increase the likelihood not only of another financial collapse or a crisis, but also increase the likelihood of future taxpayer-funded bailouts.
And I take it, Dennis Kelleher, that the this Republican bill, which has been labeled derisively as the London Whale Loophole Act, is essentially going to eviscerate the 2010 Dodd-Frank financial reform law, and the CTFC, of course, is the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. They have jurisdiction over derivatives, and essentially they just want to deregulate. I mean, take it away altogether. And this is about the only part of Dodd-Frank. I mean, all of Dodd-Frank's under assault, right? But this is an incredibly important pillar of it, isn't it?
Well, you're right in both points, Ian. All of Dodd-Frank is under massive assault by Wall Street's unlimited resources because they want to protect their business lines and their bonuses, and they don't care about who gets the bill the next time, just like they still don't care about who got the bill last time. And you're also correct that the derivatives part of a Dodd-Frank is crucially important and under intense assault. I call it Wall Street's war on regulation. And the two places where Wall Street has been most aggressive in fighting regulation are derivatives and what's called the Volcker Rule, which bans proprietary trading. And that's because those two areas are the most lucrative areas for Wall Street, where they get the biggest profits and, surprise, surprise, the biggest bonuses. So they are sparing no expense, no lawyer, no lobbyist, no political campaign contribution. They are sparing nothing to do everything they can to either gut, weaken, or prevent the implementation of derivatives regulation.
But along with the bonuses and profits in this lucrative derivatives markets, they also have the most catastrophic losses. It was only last year that J.P. Morgan Chase lost more than $6 billion in bad trades in London. I mean, how soon they forget?
Well, you know, there's the old saying that it's hard to convince somebody of something when his paycheck depends on him not believing it. And in this case, the paychecks come fast and furious to the lawyers, the lobbyists, the revolving door, and campaign contributions. So too often it's It's willful blindness and forgetting, and it's amnesia. It's funny, in Washington, D.C., if you listen to people talk about financial reform and the regulation of derivatives, you would think that the financial reform bill was the product of immaculate conception, as if there was no antecedent act that gave rise to it. They talk about the legislation and the rules as if there was never a financial crisis or a financial collapse or massive bailouts or 10.3% unemployment or millions foreclosed on. And that serves the purposes of Wall Street and its many purchased allies and mouthpieces, but it's a gross and unforgivable disservice to the American people, who not only have to pick up the bill for the next bailout, but they're still paying the bill for the last one. I mean, Better Markets put out a report showing that the last crisis over 10 years is going to cost the American people no less than $12.8 trillion. And that report's available on our website, and it's been widely cited. And that those costs continue today. You know, people talk about the extraordinary action by the Fed, where they have zero interest rates and quantitative easing and asset purchasing. All of that, almost 5 years after the collapse of Lehman Brothers, all of that is necessary, whether you agree or disagree, because they're trying to mitigate the dire economic consequences of the financial collapse. Everybody talks about we must cut the deficit. The deficit's out of control. Why did the deficit go to over $1 trillion a year? Because of the financial collapse. The crash of 08 was the worst crash since 1929. It delivered us the worst economy since the Great Depression. That caused a massive drop in government revenues and a massive increase in the need for government spending on unemployment, health care, poverty programs. Everywhere in this country, coast to coast, suffered the economic wreckage that Wall Street caused in the financial collapse and that we're still paying for today. And yet, here we are, where the Congress of the House passes a bill that would roll back and deregulate significant provisions of financial reform that are meant to protect the American people from that ever happening again.
Again, I'm speaking with Dennis Kelleher, who is the President and Chief Executive Officer of Better Markets, Inc., a Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit organization that promotes the public interest in the U.S. and global financial markets. Better Markets is a Wall Street watchdog and has been referred to as a persistent thorn in the side of Wall Street. Dennis has held several senior staff positions in the United States Senate, most recently as Chief Counsel and Senior Leadership Advisor to the Chairman of the Senate Democratic Policy Committee. Now, specifically what this House bill that's just passed does, we mentioned how they've sweetened it with $19 billion worth of Christmas gifts. You say it's Christmas in July for Wall Street, Christmas gifts for the members to get them to sign on. And, of course, you've also argued that the House bill is nothing more than a backdoor way to killing derivative reforms. But specifically, they want to shift authority away from the Consumer Commodities Futures Trading Commission to the SEC. Now, explain how that ruse works.
As most people know, the last financial crisis was, invisibly incubated in the derivatives market. It ignited the financial crisis. And importantly, derivatives acted as a conveyor belt to transmit the crisis throughout the globe. The CFTC, and a law that was passed in 1999, was prohibited. A law passed by the Congress and signed by President Clinton prohibited the CFTC from regulating in any way those derivatives. So what happened in Dodd-Frank and the financial reform law is that Congress reversed that decision and said to the CFTC, which is the agency that is an expert in derivatives and has regulated the $50 trillion a year or so futures market, said you have jurisdiction and therefore we're going to give you the authority to regulate those derivatives to prevent that from happening again. Now, the SEC is a sister regulatory agency that has jurisdiction for the securities markets, like the equity markets that people all think of when they think of the S&P or the New York Stock Exchange. So what happened is the CFTC puts out a rule that was very strong on regulating derivatives, and it was required to do so under the financial reform law. The SEC, after the CFTC did that 2.5 years ago and has been working on that regulation for 2.5 years, the SEC put its rule out about a month ago. It just started, and its rule relates to a very small fraction of derivatives. In fact, the CFTC has jurisdiction for more than 96.5% of the derivatives market, which globally is almost $700 trillion large. The SEC has less than 3.5% of that jurisdiction for that market. And the SEC are not the experts, and the CFTC is. But nonetheless, the SEC put out a rule that was supposedly in the interest of governing its 3.5% of the market. It's a very weak rule. It's already loophole-laden. And as soon as the SEC announced it, literally Wall Street's paid mouthpieces all cheered, one of which put out a press release singing the glories of the SEC. And, of course, those very same Wall Street organs have been pounding the CFTC mercilessly. So Wall Street's allies all of a sudden decided, wait a minute, the CFTC shouldn't take any action. The CFTC should, but the euphemism is, harmonize its rule with the SEC. It's yet another avenue by which, frankly, the very people that brought on the last financial crisis are trying to grease the skids to enrich themselves at everybody else's expense yet again by trying to prevent the CFTC from doing not only its job but what it's actually required to do under the law and say, oh, wait for the SEC. You've been working on it for 2.5 years and the SEC's been working on it for a few months and you've got 96.5% of the market and the SEC's got 3% and you've got decades of expertise and the SEC has virtually none, but wait, you now have to be bootstrapped to the SEC. And to mix my metaphors, they're trying to hold the CFTC hostage to the SEC in a way that would be laughable to anybody that didn't have a financial interest or stake in the outcome.
So again, Dennis Kelleher, the President and Chief Executive Officer of Better Markets, Inc., the pushback, from my understanding, is coming from 8 Democratic senators, Merkley Levin, Elizabeth Warren, Tom Harkin, Jean Shaheen, Barbara Boxer, Richard Blumenthal, and Dianne Feinstein. And I have sent letters to the CFTC chairman, Gary Gensler, and the SEC chairwoman, Mary Jo White, saying that the CFTC and the SEC have failed to deal with these shadowy financial entities that are sponsored by U.S. banks without any explicit legal guarantee for their obligations. In other words, this is the concern that these U.S. firms will simply route much of their derivative business through these shadowy entities, leaving the financial system operating as it did before the crash.
Well, right, and you know those 6 senators are
eight.
Those 6 senators are doing a terrific job, but they are a lonely voice fighting hard. There are a bunch of senators and House members who were actually pushing the Wall Street line here, and you're right, because cross-border jurisdiction of derivatives means that all the regulation that we put in place for the trading of derivatives in the U.S. will be gutted, because all these companies will just ship their derivatives business overseas, which we know today with a click of a mouse, you can move billions, if not trillions of dollars around the globe with nobody knowing it, and putting great risk back on the backs of the American taxpayer. We know from AIG and the London Whale and Citigroup and Bear Stearns and Long-Term Capital Management, there are endless examples of big U.S. banks and financial institutions doing high-risk trading and investments overseas across the U.S. border. And they ship the jobs overseas. They ship the revenue overseas. It's really great for London and other places in the world. But when things blow up overseas, it's always funny, but the bill comes right back to the American taxpayer. The United States bailed out the global financial system in 2008. No other country in the world did. Britain bailed out its banks. Other countries bailed out their banks. Only the United States bailed out the global system. 19 of 21 of the AIG counterparties that were bailed out were foreign banks. 9 of the top 20 recipients of bailout aid from the Fed were foreign banks. So if the United States taxpayer and government are going to have to bail out the globe again, then the CFTC ought to be regulating the offshore activities of Wall Street's huge derivatives dealers to eliminate or minimize the risk of those bailouts yet again. Because the recklessness of Wall Street and its unending pursuits of unlimited bonuses are not going to regulate themselves or protect the United States financial system or U.S. taxpayers. And neither are foreign regulators who have repeatedly, miserably failed to protect their own taxpayers, their own depositors, and their own treasuries, all of whom are suffering. You go to the U.K., France, Germany, Italy, Spain, Greece, go anywhere you want, but you can find endless examples of where they've had to nationalize banks and shift private bank balance sheets onto the taxpayers' back, and they're breaking their own taxpayers' backs. Why would the United States want to outsource the protection of American taxpayers to failed foreign regulators? And that's what they're trying to do here.
So, Dennis Kelleher, you mentioned that the derivatives market is about $50 trillion, which is a mind-numbing figure. I recall some time ago that Warren Buffett described derivatives as financial weapons of mass destruction. It feels like nobody's listening here or their memories have been erased. Just describe to us how do they make money off these very nebulous instruments that a lot of people don't understand, including the people who seem to participate in them?
Well, that's a good point. I should mention the futures market alone is about $50 trillion. The worldwide derivatives market, including all the swaps, are closer to $700 trillion.
Wait a second. $700 trillion. Okay, let's digest that figure. Go ahead.
So the banks deal with all sorts of customers around the world who need to hedge products, be they interest rate hedges or things like that. So, you know, much of the derivatives trading provides important services to corporations and businesses dealing all over the world. The problem is when they're unregulated and non-transparent, Wall Street gets to then do all these side bets based on their customer bets. And they're highly leveraged, and therefore they're very high risk. And when there's no transparency or regulation, they also get to charge whatever they want because their customers, no matter how sophisticated or smart they may be, and no matter how big a corporation they are, their customers can't go shopping for comparison prices like we all do for everything else. So the idea of financial reform is to require regulation of the market and to have transparency, which is not only good for the customers, but it's also good for financial stability, and it prevents the likelihood of an unseen risk growing and a crisis happening without people knowing it's even happening. And that's what regulation is supposed to do. And you're dead right in that it's an incredibly complex subject. I mean, one of the things Better Markets has tried to do is put a massive amount of information on our website.
What is that website? You've mentioned it twice. What is it?
It's www.bettermarkets.com. And we also tweet about this quite a bit, at Better Markets is the handle. And I agree it's complex, and we try and talk about this in a relatively understandable fashion and connect the dots so that people understand what's at stake. Because although it is kind of mind-numbingly complex, the end of the day, it's actually quite simple. Derivatives were at the core of the last crisis. Whether anybody understands exactly what they were, there's no dispute that they were at the core of the last crisis. There's also no legitimate dispute that they caused massive multi-hundred-billion-dollar losses, if not trillions in losses, which not only precipitated the collapse of the financial system, but actually required the bailouts by U.S. taxpayers and the government. And there's also no real genuine dispute by anybody not on the payroll of Wall Street that the financial reform law that was passed is meant and designed to prevent that from happening again. That's what the CFTC is trying to do. We are fortunate that the chairman of the CFTC, Gary Gensler, is a former partner of Goldman Sachs. And normally what happens with the revolving door is people take their public service and they sell it to the highest bidder on Wall Street, and then they use it against the public. And that's become a rather unfortunately acceptable but disreputable activity. Gary Gensler is the exception that proves the rule. He was on Wall Street and is now a public servant, being the chairman of the CFTC, and he knows exactly how Wall Street does what it does, how it engages in high-risk trading, how it conceals it, how it evades the rules and the laws to do it, how it creates loopholes. And he has, with the other commissioners at the CFTC, put out a very strong cross-border guidance last year that he's now trying to finalize. And the deadline is this Friday the 12th, and hopefully he will convince. He's got two votes for it, two votes against it, and there's one commissioner at the CFTC who's trying to decide which way he's going to vote. Hopefully he'll vote with Chairman Gensler and they'll pass very strong cross-border derivatives regulation, and Wall Street will not be successful in its war, at least after this particular battle of the war, this time. But it is marshaling, as you said earlier, Ian, all its resources, all its purchased political allies, all its ideological allies, and anybody else it can find who it can enlist into its side to prevent this from happening.
Well, Dennis Kelleher, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks, Ian. Nice to be with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Dennis Kelleher, who is the President and Chief Executive Officer of Better Markets, Inc., a Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit organization that promotes the public interest in the U.S. and global financial markets. Better Markets is a Wall Street watchdog and has been referred to as a persistent thorn in the side of Wall Street. Dennis has held several senior staff positions in the United States Senate, most recently as the Chief Counsel and Senior Leadership Advisor to the Chairman of the Senate Democratic Policy Committee. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Jose Benavides and assistant producer Claire Goldsmith. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.